It crossed her mind to reflect that Desiderata had been very lax on that point. The one thing you could be sure of, if you told Granny Weatherwax and Nanny Ogg not to help, was that they would rush to help, if only out of spite. It was quite surprising to Magrat that anyone as clever as Desiderata should have slipped up on that minor point. She'd probably got a psycholology too, whatever that was. Moving quietly, so as not to wake the other two, she opened the door and stepped lightly into the damp air. Wand at the ready, she was prepared to give the world whatever it wished for. It would help if this included pumpkins. Nanny Ogg opened one eye as the door creaked shut. She sat up and yawned and scratched herself. She fumbled in her hat and retrieved her pipe. She nudged Granny Weatherwax in the ribs.
"I ain't asleep," said Granny.
"Mugrat's gone off somewhere."
"Hm."
"And I'm going out to get something to eat," muttered Nanny.
There was no talking to Esme when she was in that kind of mood. As she stepped out, Grebo dropped lightly off a beam and landed on her shoulder. Nanny Ogg, one of life's great optimists, stepped out to take whatever the future had to offer, preferably with rum and bananas in it. The house wasn't hard to find. Desiderata had made very exact notes. Magrat's gaze took in the high white walls and ornate metal balconies. She tried to straighten a few wrinkles in her dress, tugged some recalcitrant bits of hay from her hair, and then marched up the driveway and knocked on the door. The knocker broke off in her hand. Looking around anxiously, lest someone should have noted this vandalism, Magrat tried to wedge it back. It fell off, knocking a lump out of the marble step. Finally, she knocked gently with her knuckle. A fine cloud of paint dust lifted off the door and floated down to the ground. That was the only effect. Magrat considered her next move. She was pretty sure that fairy godmothers weren't supposed to leave a little card pushed under the door saying something like, "Called today, but you were out. Please contact the depot for a further appointment." Anyway, this wasn't the kind of house that got left empty. There would be a score of servants infesting a place like this. She crunched over the gravel and peered around the side of the house. Maybe the back door. Witches were generally more at home around back doors. Nanny Ogg always was. She was heading for the one belonging to the palace. It was easy enough to get into. This wasn't a castle like the ones back home, which expressed very clear ideas about inside and outside and were built to keep the two separate. This was, well, a fairy tale castle, all icing sugar battlements and tiny towering turrets. Anyway, no one took much notice of little old ladies. Little old ladies were by definition harmless, although in a string of villages across several thousand miles of continent, this definitely was currently being updated. Castles, in Nanny Ogg's experience, were like swans. They looked as if they were drifting regally through the waters of time, but in fact there was a hell of a lot of activity going on underneath. There'd be a maze of pantries and kitchens and laundries and stables and breweries. She liked the idea of breweries. And people never noticed another old biddy around the place, eating any spare grub that was lying around. Besides, you got gossip. Nanny Ogg liked gossip, too. Granny Weatherwax wandered disconsolately along the clean streets. She wasn't looking for the other two. She was quite certain of that. Of course, she might just happen to bump into them, sort of accidentally, and give them a meaningful look, but she certainly wasn't looking for them. There was a crowd at the end of the street. Working on the reasonable assumption that Nanny Ogg might be in the middle of it, Granny Weatherwax drifted over. Nanny wasn't there, but there was a raised platform and a small man in chains and some bright uniformed guards. One of them was holding an axe. You did not have to be a great world traveller to understand that the purpose of this tableau was not to give the chained man a signed testimonial and a collection from everyone at the office. Granny nudged a bystander. "What's happening?" The man looked sideways at her.
"The guards have caught him thieving," he said.
"Eh, well, he looks guilty enough," said Granny. People in chains had a tendency to look guilty. "So what are they going to do to him?"
"Teach him a lesson."
"How do they do that, then?"
"See the axe?"
Granny's eyes hadn't left it the whole time, but now she let her attention rove over the crowd, picking up scraps of thought. An ant has an easy mind to read. There's just one stream of big, simple thoughts. Carry, carry, bite. Get into the sandwiches, carry, eat. Something like a dog is more complicated. A dog can be thinking several thoughts at the same time, but a human mind is a great sullen, lightning-filled cloud of thoughts, all of them occupying a finite amount of brain processing time. Finding whatever the owner thinks they're thinking in the middle of the smog of prejudices, memories, worries, hopes, and fears is almost impossible. But enough people thinking much the same thing can be heard,
and Granny Weatherwax was aware of the fear.
"Looks like it'll be a lesson he won't forget in a hurry," she murmured.
"I reckon he'll forget it quite quickly," said the watcher,
and then shuffled away from Granny in the same way that people move away from lightning rods during a thunderstorm. At this point, Granny picked up the discordant note in the orchestra of thought. In the middle of it were two minds that were not human. Their shape was as simple, clean and purposeful as a naked blade. She'd felt minds like that before and had never cherished the experience. She scanned the crowd and found the mind's owners. They were staring unblinkingly at the figures on the platform. The watchers were women, or at least currently the same shape as women. Taller than she was, slender as sticks, and wearing broader hats with veils that covered their faces. Their dresses shimmered in the sunlight. Possibly blue, possibly yellow, possibly green. Possibly patterned. It was impossible to tell. The merest movement changed the colours. She couldn't make out their faces. There were witches in Genua, all right. One witch, anyway. A sound from the platform made her turn, and she knew why people in Genua were quiet and nice. There were countries in foreign parts, Granny had heard, where they chopped off the hands of thieves so they wouldn't steal again, and she'd never been happy with that idea. They didn't do that in Genua. They cut their heads off so they wouldn't think of stealing again. Granny knew exactly where the witches were in Genua now. They were in charge. Magrat reached the house's back door. It was ajar. She pulled herself together again. She knocked in a polite, diffident sort of way. She said. A bowl full of dirty water hit her full in the face. Through the tidal roaring of a pair of ears full of suds, she heard a voice say, "Oh, gosh, I'm sorry. I didn't know anyone was standing there." Magrat wiped the water out of her eyes and tried to focus on a dim figure in front of her. A kind of narrative certainty rose in her mind. "Is your name Ella?" she said.
"That's right. Who are you?"
Magrat looked at her newfound goddaughter up and down. She was the most attractive young woman Magrat had ever seen. Skin as brown as a nut, hair so blonde as to be almost white. A combination not totally unusual in such an easy-going city as Genua had once been. "What were you supposed to say at a time like this?" She removed a piece of potato peel from her nose.
"I'm your fairy godmother," she said. "Funny thing, it sounds silly now I come to tell someone."
Ella peered at her.
"You?"
"Yes, I've got the wand and everything." Magrat waggled the wand in case this helped. It didn't. Ella put her head on one side.
"I thought you people were supposed to appear in a shower of glittering little lights and a twinkly noise," she said suspiciously.
"Look, you just get the wand," said Magrat desperately. "You don't get a whole book of instructions."
Ella gave her another searching look. Then she said,
"Suppose you'd better come in, then. You're just in time. I was making a cup of tea, anyway."
The iridescent women got into an open-topped carriage. Beautiful as they were, Granny noted, they walked awkwardly. Well, they would. They wouldn't be used to legs. She also noticed the way people didn't look at the carriage. It wasn't that they didn't see it. It was simply that they wouldn't let their gaze dwell on it, as if merely recognizing it would lead them into trouble. And she noticed the coach horses. They had better senses than the humans did. They knew what was behind them, and they didn't like it at all. She followed them as they trotted flat-eared and wild-eyed through the streets. Eventually they were driven into a driveway of a big, dilapidated house near the palace. Granny lurked by the wall and noted the details. Plaster was dropping off the house walls, and even the knocker had fallen off the door. Granny Weatherwax did not believe in atmospheres. She did not believe in psychic auras. Being a witch, she'd always thought, depended more on what you didn't believe. But she was prepared to believe that there was something very unpleasant in that house. Not evil. The two not-exactly women weren't evil, in the same way that a dagger or a sheer cliff isn't evil. Being evil means being able to make choices. But the hand wielding a dagger or pushing a body over a cliff could be evil. And something like that was going on. She really wished that she didn't know who was behind it. People like Nanny Ogg turn up everywhere. It's as if there's some special morphic generator dedicated to the production of old women who like a laugh and aren't averse to the odd pint, especially if some drink normally sold in very small glasses. You find them all over the place, often in pairs. Always in front of you in any queue, for a start. They tend to attract one another. Possibly they broadcast inaudible signals indicating that here is someone who could be persuaded to go, "Ooh," too, at pictures of other people's grandchildren. Nanny Ogg had found a friend. Her name was Mrs. Pleasant. She was a cook, and she was the first black person Nanny had ever spoken to. Racism was not a problem on the Discworld, because, what with trolls and dwarfs and so on, speciesism was much more interesting. Black and white lived in perfect harmony and ganged up on green. She was also a cook, and of that very superior type who spends most of the time holding court in a chair in the centre of the kitchen, apparently taking very little heed of the activity going on around her. Occasionally she'd give an order, and they'd only need to be occasionally, because she'd seen to it over the years that people either did things her way, or not at all. Once or twice, with some ceremony, she'd get up, taste something, and maybe add a pinch of salt. Such people are always ready to chat to any wandering peddlers, herbalists, or little old women with cats on their shoulders. Grebo rode on Nanny's shoulder as though he'd just eaten the parrot. "You be a-comin' here for fat lunchtime, then?" said Mrs. Pleasant. "Helping a friend with a bit of business," said Nanny. "My, these biscuits are tasty." "I means I see by your eye," said Mrs. Pleasant, pushing the plate nearer to her, "that you are of a magical persuasion." "Then you sees a lot further than most people in these parts," said Nanny. "You know what'd improve these biscuits no end? It'd be something to dip 'em in. What you think?" "How about something with bananas in it?" "Bananas would be just the thing," said Nanny happily. Mrs. Pleasant waved imperiously at one of the maids who set to work. Nanny sat on her chair, swinging her stumpy legs and looking around the kitchen with interest. A score of cooks were working with the single-mindedness of an artillery platoon laying down a barrage. Huge cakes were being constructed. In the fireplaces, whole carcasses of animals were being roasted. Turnspit dogs galloped in their treadmills. A huge man with a bald head and a scar right across his face was patiently inserting little sticks into sausages. Nanny hadn't had any breakfast. Grebo had had some breakfast, but this didn't make any difference. They were both undergoing a sort of exquisite culinary torture. They both turned as if hypnotized to watch two maids stagger under a tray of canapés.
"I can see you is a very observant woman, Mrs. Ogg," said Mrs. Pleasant.
"Just a slice," said Nanny, without thinking.
"I also determines," Mrs. Pleasant said after a while, "that you have a cat of no usual breed upon your shoulder there."
"You're right there.
I knows I'm right."
A brimming glass of yellow foam was slid in front of Nanny. She looked at it reflectively and tried to get back to the matter in hand.
"So," she said, "where would I go, do you think, to find out about how you do magic in—"
"Would you like something to eat?" said Mrs. Pleasant.
"What? Oh, my word!" Mrs. Pleasant rolled her eyes. "Not this stuff."
"I wouldn't eat this stuff," she said bitterly.
Nanny's face fell. "But you cook it," she pointed out.
"Only 'cause I'm told to. The old baron knew what good food was. This stuff, it's nothing but pork and beef and lamb and rubbish for them that never tasted anything better. The only things on four legs that's worth eating is alligator. I mean, real food."
Mrs. Pleasant looked around the kitchen.
"Sarah," she shouted.
One of the sub-cooks turned round.
"Yes'm?" "Me and this lady is just going out. Just you see to everything, okay?"
"Yes'm." Mrs. Pleasant stood up and nodded meaningfully at Nanny Ogg.
"Wolves have ears," she said.
"Cough, do they?
We going to go for a little stroll."
There were, it now seemed to Nanny Ogg, two cities in Genua. There was the white one, all new houses and blue-roofed palaces, and around it, and even under it, was the old one. The new one might not like the presence of the old one, but it couldn't quite ever do without it. Someone, somewhere, has to do the cooking. Nanny Ogg quite liked cooking, provided there were other people around to do things like chop up the vegetables and wash the dishes afterwards. She'd always reckoned that she could do things to a bit of beef that the bullock had never thought of, but now she realised that wasn't cooking. Not compared to cooking in Genua. It was just staying alive as pleasantly as possible. Cooking anywhere outside Genua was just heating things up like bits of animals and birds and fish and vegetables until they went brown. And yet the weird thing was that the cooks in Genua had nothing edible to cook. At least not what Nanny would have thought of as food. To her mind, food went around on four legs, or possibly one pair of legs and one pair of wings. Or at least it had fins on. The idea of food with more than four legs was an entirely new kettle of miscellaneous swimming things.
They didn't have much to cook in Genoa, so they cooked everything. Nanny had never heard of prawns or crawfish or lobsters. It just looked to her as though the citizens of Genoa dredged the river bottom and boiled whatever came up. The point was that a good, genuine cook could more or less take the squeezing of a handful of mud, a few dead leaves, and a pinch or two of some unpronounceable herbs, and produce a meal to make a gourmet burst into tears of gratitude and swear to be a better person for the rest of their entire life, if they could just have one more plateful. Nanny Ogg ambled along as Mrs. Pleasant led her through the market. She peered at cages of snakes and racks of mysteriously tendrilled herbs. She prodded trays of bivalves. She stopped for a chat to Nanny Ogg-shaped ladies who ran the little stalls that, for a couple of pennies, dispensed strange chowders and shellfish in a bun. She sampled everything. She was enjoying herself immensely. Genoa, city of cooks, had found the appetite it deserved. She finished a plate of fish and exchanged a nod and a grin with the little old woman who ran the fish stall. "Well, all this is," she began, turning to Mrs. Pleasant. Mrs. Pleasant had gone. Some people would have bustled off to look for her in the crowds, but Nanny Ogg just stood and thought. "I asked her about magic," she thought, "and she brought me here and left me. Because of them walls with ears in, I expect. So maybe I got to do the rest myself." She looked around her. There was a very rough tent a little way from the stalls, right by the river. There was no sign outside it, but there was a pot bubbling gently over a fire. Rough clay bowls were stacked beside the pot. Occasionally someone would step out of the crowd, help themselves to a bowl of whatever it was in the pot, and then throw a handful of coins into the plate in front of the tent. Nanny wandered over and looked into the pot. Things came to the surface and sank again. The general colour was brown. Bubbles formed, grew, and burst stickily with an organic blop. Anything could be happening in that pot. Life could be spontaneously creating. Nanny Ogg would try anything once. Some things she'd try several thousand times. She unhooked the ladle, picked up a bowl, and helped herself. A moment later, she pushed aside the tent flap and looked into the blackness of the interior. A figure was seated cross-legged in the gloom, smoking a pipe. "Mind if I step inside?" said Nanny. The figure nodded. Nanny sat down. After a decent interval, she pulled out her own pipe. "Mrs. Pleasant's a friend of yours, I expect."
"She knows me."
"Ah!" From outside there was the occasional clink as customers helped themselves. Blue smoke coiled from Nanny Ogg's pipe. "I don't reckon," she said, "that many people goes away without paying."
"No."
After another pause, Nanny Ogg said, "I expect some of them tries to pay with gold and jewels and scented ungulates and stuff like that."
"No." "Amazing."
Nanny Ogg sat in silence for a while, listening to the distant noises of the market and summoning her powers.
"What's it called?"
"Gumbo."
"It's good."
"I know."
"I reckon anyone who could cook like that could do anything."
Nanny Ogg concentrated.
"Mrs. Goggle."
She waited.
"Pretty near, Mrs. Ogg."
The two women stared at one another's shadowy outline, like plotters who had given the sign and countersign and were waiting to see what would happen next.
"Where I come from, we call it witchcraft," said Nanny, under her breath.
"Where I come from, we call it voodoo,"
said Mrs. Goggle. Nanny's wrinkled forehead wrinkled still further. "Ain't that all messing with dolls and dead people and stuff?" she said.
"Ain't witchcraft all running around with no clothes on and sticking pins in people?"
said Mrs. Goggle, levelly.
"Ah," said Nanny,
"I see what you mean." She shifted uneasily. She was a fundamentally honest woman. "I got to admit, though," she added, "sometimes, maybe, just one pin." Mrs. Goggle nodded gravely.
"Okay, sometimes, maybe just one zombie," she said.
"But only when there ain't no alternative."
"Sure, when there ain't no alternative."
"When, you know, people ain't showing respect, like."
"When the house needs painting."
Nanny grinned toothily. Mrs. Goggle grinned, outnumbering her in teeth by a factor of 30.
"My full name's Githa Ogg," she said. "People calls me Nanny."
"My full name's Erzuli Goggle," said Mrs. Goggle. "People call me Mrs. Goggle."
"The way I saw it," said Nanny,
This is foreign parts, so maybe there's a different kind of magic. Stands to reason. The trees is different, the people is different, the drinks is different, and has got banana in them. So the magic will be different too. Then I thought, Githa, my girl, you're never too old to learn. Sure thing. There's something wrong with this city. Felt it as soon as we set foot here. Mrs. Gogol nodded. There was no sound for a while but the occasional puffing of a pipe. Then there was a clink from outside, followed by a thoughtful pause. A voice said, Githa, Og, I know you're in there. The outline of Mrs. Gogol took its pipe out of its mouth. That's good, she said. Good sense of taste there. The tent flap opened. Hello, Esme, said Nanny Og. Blessings be on this, tent, said Granny Weatherwax, peering into the gloom. This is Mrs. Gogol, said Nanny. She's by way of being a voodoo lady. That's what witches are in these parts. They ain't the only witches in these parts, said Granny. Mrs. Gogol was very impressed at you detecting me in here, said Nanny. It wasn't hard, said Granny. Once I'd spotted that Grebo washing himself outside, the rest was all deduction. In the gloom of the tent, Nanny had formed a mental picture of Mrs. Gogol as being old. What she hadn't expected, when the voodoo lady stepped out into the open air, was a handsome, middle-aged woman taller than Granny. Mrs. Gogol wore heavy gold earrings, a white blouse, and a full red skirt with flounces. Nanny could feel Granny Weatherwax's disapproval. What they said about women with red skirts was even worse than whatever they said about women with red shoes, whatever that was. Mrs. Gogol stopped and raised an arm. There was a flurry of wings. Grebo, who had been rubbing obsequiously against Nanny's leg, looked up and hissed. The largest and blackest cockerel Nanny had ever seen had settled on Mrs. Gogol's shoulder. It turned on her the most intelligent stare she had ever seen on a bird. My word, she said, taken aback. That's the biggest cock I've ever seen, and I've seen a few in my time. Mrs. Gogol raised one disapproving eyebrow.
She never had no proper upbringing, said Granny.
What with living next to a chicken farm and all is what I was going to say next, said Nanny.
This is Legbar, a dark and dangerous spirit, said Mrs. Gogol. She leaned closer and spoke out of the corner of her mouth. Between you and me, he's just a big black cockerel, but you know how it is.
It pays to advertise, Nanny agreed. This is Grebo. Between you and me, he's a fiend from hell.
Well, he's a cat, said Mrs. Gogol generously. It's only to be expected.
Dear Jason and everyone, isn't it amazing the things what happen when you don't expect it? For example, we met Mrs. Gogol, who works as a cook by day but is a voodoo witch. You mustn't believe all the stuff about black magic, etc. This is a blind. She's just like us, only different. It's true about the zombies, though, but it's not what you think.
Genua was a strange city, Nanny decided. You got off the main streets, walked along a side road, went through a little gate, and suddenly there were trees everywhere with moss and them llamas hanging from them, and the ground began to wobble underfoot and become swamp. On either side of the track there were dark pools in which, here and there among the lilies, were the kind of logs the witches had never seen before.
"Them's bloody big newts," she said.
"They're alligators."
"By gods, they must get good grub."
"Yeah."
Mrs. Gogol's house itself looked a simple affair of driftwood from the river, roofed with moss and built out over the swamp itself on four stout poles. It was close enough to the centre of the city that Nanny could hear street cries and the clip-clop of hooves, but the shack in its little swamp was wreathed in silence.
"Don't people bother you here?" said Nanny.
"Not them as I don't want to meet."
The lily pads moved. A V-shaped ripple drifted across the nearest pool.
"Self-reliance," said Granny approvingly. "That's always very important."
Nanny regarded the reptiles with a calculating stare. They tried to match it and gave up when their eyes started watering.
"I reckon I could just do with a couple of them at home," she said thoughtfully, as they slid away again. "Our Jason could dig another pond, no problem. What was it you said they ate?"
"Anything they want to." "I know the joke about alligators," said Granny, in the tones of one announcing a great and solemn truth.
"You never," said Nanny Og. "I never heard you tell a joke in your whole life."
"Just because I don't tell 'em don't mean I don't know 'em," said Granny haughtily. "It's about this man."
"What man?" said Nanny.
"This man went into an inn." "Yes, it was an inn, and he saw a sign, and the sign said, 'We serve every kind of sandwich,
So he said, get me an alligator sandwich and make it quick.
They looked at her. Nanny Ogg turned to Mrs. Goggle. So, you live alone here, then, she said brightly. Not a living soul around.
In a manner of speaking, said Mrs. Goggle. You see, the point is, alligators...
Granny began in a loud voice and then stopped. The shack's door had opened. This was another big kitchen. As Desiderata said, fairy godmothers tend to get heavily involved with kitchens. Once upon a time, it had provided employment for half a dozen cooks. Now it was a cave, its far corners shadowy, its hanging saucepans and tureens dulled by dust. The big tables had been pushed to one side and stacked almost ceiling high with ancient crockery. The stoves, which looked big enough to take whole cows and cook for an army, stood cold. In the middle of the grey desolation, someone had set up a small table by the fireplace. It was on a square of bright carpet. A jam jar contained flowers that had been arranged by the simple method of grabbing a handful of them and ramming them in. The effect was a little area of slightly soppy brightness in the general gloom. Ella shuffled a few things around desperately and then stood looking at Magrat with a sort of defensively shy smile.
Silly of me, really. I expect you're used to this sort of thing, she said.
Yes, all the time, said Magrat.
It was just that I expected you to be a bit older. Apparently you were at my christening.
Yes, said Magrat. Well, you see, the thing is, still, I expect you can look like whatever you want, said Ella helpfully.
Ah, yes,
Ella looked slightly puzzled for a moment, as if trying to work out why, if Magrat could look like whatever she wanted, she'd chosen to look like Magrat.
Well, now, she said, what do we do next?
You mentioned tea, said Magrat, buying time.
Oh, sure.
Ella turned to the fireplace, where a blackened kettle hung over what Granny Weatherwax always called an optimist's fire. Two logs and hope.
What's your name? She said over her shoulder.
Magrat, said Magrat, sitting.
That's a nice name, said Ella, politely.
Of course, you know mine. Mind you, I spend so much time cooking over this wretched thing now that Mrs. Pleasant calls me Embers.
Silly, isn't it?
Emberella, thought Magrat. I'm fairy godmothering a girl who sounds like something you put up in the rain.
It could use a little work, she conceded.
I haven't the heart to tell her off. She thinks it sounds jolly, she said. I think it sounds like something you put up in the rain.
Oh, I wouldn't say that, said Magrat. Who's Mrs. Pleasant?
She's the cook at the palace. She comes around to cheer me up when they're out.
Ella spun round, holding the blackened kettle like a weapon.
I'm not going to that ball, she snapped. I'm not going to marry the prince, do you understand?
The words came out like steel ingots.
Right. Right, said Magrat, taken aback by their force.
He looks slimy. He makes my flesh crawl, said Embers darkly. They say he's got funny eyes, and everyone knows what he does at night.
Everyone bar one, Magrat thought. No one ever tells me things like that. Aloud, she said,
well, it shouldn't be too much to arrange. I mean, normally it's marrying princes that's the hard bit.
Not for me it isn't, said Embers. It's all been arranged. My other godmother says I've got to do it. She says it's my destiny.
Other godmother? Said Magrat.
Everyone gets two, said Ella. The good one and the bad one. You know that. Which one are you?
Magrat's mind raced.
The good one, she said. Definitely.
Funny thing, said Ella. That's just what the other one said, too.
Granny Weatherwax sat in her special knees-clenched, elbows-in way that put as little as possible of herself in contact with the outside world.
By gaw, this is good stuff,
said Nanny Ogg, polishing her plate with what Granny could only hope was bread.
You ought to try a drop, Esme.
Another helping, Mrs. Ogg? Said Mrs. Goggle.
Don't mind if I do, Mrs. Goggle.
Nanny nudged Granny in the ribs. It's really good, Esme, just like stew. Mrs. Goggle looked at Granny with her head on one side.
I think perhaps Mistress Weatherwax isn't worried about the food, she said. I think Mistress Weatherwax is worried about the service.
A shadow loomed over Nanny Ogg. A grey hand took her plate away.
Granny Weatherwax gave a little cough. "I've got nothing against dead people," she said. "Some of my best friends are dead. It just don't seem right, though, dead people walking about." Nanny Ogg looked up at the figure, even now ladling a third helping of mysterious liquid onto her plate. "What do you think about it, Mr. Zombie?"
It's a great life, Mrs. Ogg," said the zombie.
"There, see, Esme, he don't mind. Better than being shut up in a stuffy coffin all day, I'll be bound." Granny looked up at the zombie. He was, or technically had been, a tall, handsome man. He still was, only now he looked like someone who had walked through a room full of cobwebs. "What's your name, dead man?" she said.
"I am called Saturday."
"Man Saturday, eh?" said Nanny Ogg.
"No, just Saturday, Mrs. Ogg. Just Saturday."
Granny Weatherwax looked into his eyes. They were more sentient than most eyes she had seen that belonged to people who were technically alive.